Before the court is the case of Lytle versus Rosemere Estate Property Owners. It's case number 54886. Good morning, Mr. Sterling.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court, Bob Sterling, on behalf of the appellant, the Lytles.
And do you wish to reserve time?
I certainly will try, Your Honor.
Very well.
The issue before the court today is the meaning of the phrase decision and award in an NRED arbitration proceeding. Our argument is that when the legislature used the phrase decision and award in the statute to set the time for the 30 days for a trial de novo running, that they literally and necessarily meant the final decisional act of the arbitrator, completely disposing of the claim that was submitted to the arbitrator in the NRED arbitration proceeding. District Court disagreed. And we get to this issue because in this case, we had two documents from the arbitrator. The first one on May 4th referred to or titled a non-binding arbitration award. And the second, a short time later on June 1, called a non-binding arbitration award of costs and attorney's fees. According to the district court, it was that first document that started the 30 days running, even though that document specifically left open a decision as to what the reasonable amount of attorney's fees was going to be. Our argument is that that is part of the claim that was submitted to the court. So that first award, decision and award, even though it was called a decision and award, wasn't what was referred to in the statute to start the 30 days running.
So as long as there's not been an award of attorney's fees, it can never be a final decision?
If attorney's fees is part of the claim, yes, Your Honor, that's true. And in this case, the attorney's fees was part of the claim. It was listed in the claim, the written claim that the Lytle submitted that started the arbitration process. It was referred to in the first decision and award that the arbitrator issued, specifically finding that the association was the prevailing party, that it was entitled to attorney's fees, and that the association was to file a motion as to what the reasonable amount of fees should be, which the association then did. So in this case, the fees was the source of the fees, the authorization for the fees was the original CC&Rs. It was included as in part of the claim. It was only partially decided in that first decision and award. And I want to make a distinction here, Your Honor, because it's easy to get confused when we're talking about an arbitration proceeding versus a court proceeding. And I understand there's a special order after judgment that a trial court can issue where it will decide whether to award fees and what the amount of fees will be. That's a special order after judgment. It's separately appealable. I understand that. But there are two problems with the analogy, that analogy in this case. First of all, the first decision and award from the arbitrator, the May 4th award, didn't just leave open the issue of attorney's fees entirely. The arbitrator said association's entitled to fees, but didn't set the amount of the award. It's an important distinction. And I've cited cases in footnote 5 of my reply brief that make it very clear that although attorney's fees can be a collateral matter in a district court proceeding, if the court says that you're entitled to fees, leaves open the amount of fees is no longer collateral to that original decision. You have to decide both the amount of the fees, or you have to leave open both the amount of the fees and the entitlement to the fees in order to be collateral. That's because the amount of the fees is not collateral to a decision that says you're entitled to fees. It's a technical matter, I understand, but it's an important distinction in this case. if the court is even going to go down the road of accepting that an arbitration can have collateral matters like attorney's fees. I would submit that it doesn't, that the arbitrator has to decide all of the issues that are in the claim that's submitted as part of the NREG proceeding. And we get there for a number of reasons. I mean, first of all, we can go all the way back to the original functus officio doctrine that says that arbitrators have limited jurisdictional powers that derive from statute or from contract, that the arbitrator decides all of the issues in the arbitration, and once the arbitrator has done so, then there's no longer any jurisdiction for that arbitrator to act. And I think that's the framework that the legislature clearly had in mind when it set up this process of sending cases to NRED arbitrators. The understanding would be that the arbitrator would decide the entire claim, and at that point, the party, if it was unhappy with the mediation, could then file a complaint for a trial de novo. Does the court have any specific questions on any of those points? Court's indulgence. What I've just been discussing with regard to the special order after judgment, that addresses the argument in the answering brief that VVGNLV might apply to this case. I think it clearly does not.
You know, I have one question. You indicate in your briefs that Chapter 38 contemplates a single decision and award, and that the idea of multiple decisions from arbitration proceedings is as you indicate, are an entirely foreign concept. Where do you get that?
Well, I get that partly from the functus officio doctrine, which is the understanding that when a matter is committed to the arbitrator, that the arbitrator will decide everything and then have no further power after that point. But it's also implicit in various parts of the statutory scheme itself. You know, for example, in 38.237, subsection 4B, there's provision for the district court, if there's a motion to confirm pending, to send the matter back to the arbitrator on the grounds that the arbitrator has not made a final and definite award upon a claim submitted to the arbitral proceeding. So that's one instance where there seems to be the understanding that we'll have a complete disposition of the entire claim or the entire matter submitted to the arbitration. And if not, and if it matters to the parties, then it should be sent back to the arbitrator to complete that process. There are also discussions in various parts of the statutory scheme that talk about completing the arbitration process. As a practical matter, what NRED does, it issues a certificate of completion at the end of the proceeding, and that is a signal that everything has been completed. Now, ideally, we'd have the 30 days run from the certificate of completion, but obviously that's not what the statute says. It says from the time of notice of the decision. That's why we have the issue we have here. I'm going to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Very well, Mr. Sterling.
Thank you.
Mr. Smith.
Good morning. Jason Smith on behalf of the respondent, the Rosemere Estates Property Owners Association. As Mr. Sterling pointed out today, we're trying to determine what the phrase decision and award means. And more specifically, I think the question is whether Arbitrator Sherinian's May 4th, 2009 decision and award was sufficient to trigger the 30-day deadline. If it was, of course, then the complaint for trial de novo was untimely and all the district court's orders should be affirmed. Certainly, the association believes it was sufficient. The statute is relatively simple. It really has two components. One, that a decision and award has been served, and second, that the moving party then submits a sworn statement that all the issues addressed in their complaint have been arbitrated. What we have here with Mr. Sherinian's May 4th decision is just that. It's a very thorough decision. The Lytle's counsel and the underlying NRED claim, they were the claimant, submitted a detailed list. I believe there were 11 different issues he asked the arbitrator to address. This May 4th award addressed every single one of those issues. He made findings, he made conclusions, and he even stated there was a full exhaustion of all administrative remedies. This was an issue that at the very beginning of this torture dispute almost 4 years ago came up. That was the reason it was included. Everybody has exhausted all their administrative remedies. You may now move on to district court. That was the purpose of that component of his May 4th award. So as of the receipt of that document, the Lytles had everything they needed to comply with NRS 38.330 subsection 5 to move to district court. Notably, nowhere in their complaint for trial de novo do you see any error alleged with the award attorney fees to the association. They make numerous other mentions of items that were error, amending the CCNRs, the enforcement of the CCNRs. They don't mention the attorney fee issue. Why? Well, because it wasn't the concern that led them to district court. The applicability and the amendment of the CCNRs was the crux of the issue. It's convenient to say, well, we needed to know what the amount of the attorney fees was. That wasn't really the case here. Like I said, this is a relatively straightforward statute. I think it deserves a plain meaning interpretation. I think the terms decision and award have both received judicial interpretation, and a fair reading of those interpretations would mean decision and award is the written findings of the arbitrator announcing his or her determination of the facts and law of the case. Now, the Lytles are forced to suggest either an ambiguity in the statute or an ambiguity in the way the arbitration proceeding was handled in order to avoid the result here. With respect to the arbitration proceeding, it appears they're convinced this was a two-phase, a distinct two-phase arbitration. That wasn't the case. We have an April 7th letter to Arbitrator Sherinian that basically said...
Mr. Smith, you agree that fees was an issue in the arbitration, right?
I believe that the Lytles requested they were entitled to fees and part of their claim. I don't believe the issue presented in NRED was, is any party entitled to fees? Yes, to answer your question directly, fees was an issue. And I believe...
So how can your client, and I appreciate your point here, but I don't understand how your client could say all issues have been resolved in the arbitration when there's still one pending.
I would agree that the amount of the attorney fees and costs had not been decided. That was to be decided by the arbitrator in a post decision.
And to follow up
manner.
That okay. question with another, so you can include that in your discussion, is how would one know that they want to attack the fee award until they know what the fees are?
I don't believe they could. I think that would be something, and in this instance, I think as a practical result, I know one of the policy arguments that was raised in the brief was, well, this could lead to piecemeal litigation. If we have to appeal the decision, but it's not yet final because it doesn't have the amount, then we have to file a separate appeal of the amount. And I know that I use the Lee case not only for the purpose of saying, well, it's analogous to a district court proceeding, but that helped define what means final. But I think the reason the Lee case is fairly distinguishable but still applicable to our argument, we're not suggesting that the Lytles in this case, for example, would have to file a complaint for trial de novo as to the liability issues and the legal issues, and then file a second lawsuit, a second complaint for trial de novo as to the attorney fee award. That doesn't make sense. I think there's a lot of ability in the Nevada Rules of Civil Procedure, for example. They could file an amendment to their complaint. They could conform their argument and the evidence. I don't think a judge or an opposing party, my client in this instance, could say, no, sorry, you didn't include the amount of the attorney fees in your complaint for trial de novo. You're, you know, shut out from arguing that. I'm not sure if that's what they're reaching to say it would be unreasonable to make us appeal from the first decision. But if that answers your question, I think it is an issue that can be easily taken care of.
So you would simply suggest that they plead a vague, we disagree with the attorney fee award, but we'll amend later to conform to whatever that final decision regarding attorney's fees is.
Well, I think in this instance, the you know, all of the determinations of the legal issues, but for the amount of the fees, they could have, with specificity, or sufficient to notice pleading anyway, pled. They could have very easily said, and with the pending decision on the amount of attorney fees, we reserve our right to also challenge that.
Mr. Smith, I'm sorry.
No, I just was going to comment, and therefore it's a pending decision, it's not final.
I think the amount of the attorney fees is left, but I think the way that Nevada has defined what constitutes a final decision, that goes to the Lee case, is There's nothing left for the further consideration of the court except for post-judgment, or in this case, it would be post-arbitration issues such as fees and costs.
So you make no distinction between regular litigation process and arbitration?
No, I believe that there is a distinction to be made.
Okay.
And I believe one of the things that was said is the concept of the arbitrator's jurisdiction is terminated and he must determine all of these things at once. I think actually the example that Mr. Sterling gave might even lend support to our argument, which is if the Lytles had filed this originally, right after the May 4th award and within 30 days, and we suggested, or someone suggested, well, the attorney fee amount hasn't been awarded yet, there's a vehicle to send that back down to the arbitrator. We're not suggesting that we reopen the proceedings, but I think the analogy is correct in that there is a way to get the attorney fee issue in front of the district court.
Isn't it cleaner just to wait for the attorney's fees to be awarded? And up until that point, it's entirely likely that they aren't going to appeal anything. And you get an award of attorney's fees that, it gets your attention, you find shocking for some reason, then you decide you want to appeal it. That seems like a very clean point to say, okay, this is a final decision. Everything is done. Everything we need to consider to evaluate whether or not we want to expend the funds to appeal this is in place.
In this specific instance, I would disagree that they wouldn't have decided to appeal until they got the award. I think the testimony in the underlying case, I think the themes that are continuing, their real crux was more the application of the CC&Rs. And I know that ultimately doesn't answer your question. In this case, I don't believe the attorney fees bore anything on their decision whether or not to appeal. I truly don't think that factored in. In normal circumstances or in other matters, I believe it could. I think,
which leads to my question, Mr. Smith. I think you might be right. They may have had less concern about the fee issue, but I'm concerned about the precedent that such an approach would have on the review of other arbitration awards under Chapter 38. What if you have a complex arbitration proceeding and there are two or three distinct separate pieces to the arbitration? Some of this is getting pretty complex anymore. And the arbitrator resolves one of them. And does that trigger the date for review, even though there are two or three others still pending? If we were to say that the 30-day date stems from the initial arbitration award, in an opinion resolving this case, then why couldn't a party say, well, the 30-day period has been triggered from the first arbitration award on the first major claim, and that there are two or three other claims, and they're not interrelated. They involve the same parties, but they're not interrelated. But yet, if you didn't file an appeal within 30 days of the first arbitration award, now you can't appeal any determination. That doesn't seem to make much sense to me.
I understand, and I believe there is an explanation. Again, in this case, I think we had a very detailed list of findings. And for example, let's say in this case there might have been 25 issues, and the first decision from Arbitrator Sherinian on May 4th only addressed 11. There were 14 left. I think our position would be much weaker in that circumstance, and I think your concern is well taken to that extent. I'm certainly not advocating that you should have if you have multiple steps of an arbitration process where, okay, I'm going to decide, in a construction case, I'm going to decide the construction aspect first, and then I'm going to decide if there was, any fault of any of the subcontractors, and then I'm going to get to this. I mean, a lot of times, and I think in cases like that, especially complex litigation situations, you'll have a lot cleaner, a lot more detailed description of how the process is going to evolve. Maybe an arbitration agreement, maybe the way that the AAA rules or whatever vehicle for arbitration use. And these NRED cases, I'm not sure that the NRED cases lend to the same complex examples as some of the other ones.
But if we're going to define a decision and award, we certainly can't do it on the number of issues. That would lead to chaos. You're suggesting that unless the various issues are set forth perhaps by way of the AAA rules or by agreement between the parties, that we could therefore clearly identify the 30 days isn't going to run until we get to phase two or phase three, or begin to run until phase two or phase three. I'm just concerned, even though this may be a simple case with really virtually one issue and the attorney's fees sort of tagging along, I'm concerned that there's still something that does not make this decision final, and therefore the clock didn't begin to run. I'm just concerned about that.
And my fear is that the one section that precedes subsection 5, which is subsection 4, it talks about that an award must be issued within 30 days after the arbitration. And if we now have a situation where, in this case, the arbitration was submitted on briefs, we didn't have a live arbitration hearing, we didn't have an evidentiary hearing. It's unique, I guess, in that regard. We have approximately 3 weeks before the arbitrator issues his court decision, and he says, well, I'd like briefing on the issue of attorney fees. And I think getting it back within a couple of weeks' time was pretty good by Arbitrator Shrinian. But now, June 1, that's beyond 30 days from when the arbitration happened. Now we might create a situation if we say, well, it's not final until after June 1. We might have a situation where the party who's unhappy with the June 1 or the May 4th award now moves to say, the arbitrator didn't comply with Section 4 and getting his arbitration out or award out in 30 days. Now there's a problem. Are they challenging the validity of it? Are they moving to strike it? Do we have to go back and start the whole arbitration process over? I think there might be some inconsistencies in the different 30 days. And so from this instance, I think Arbitrator Shirinian did a great job with long briefs, 50-page briefs in this case, surprisingly, to get all this back to us in a relatively short time. But I think if we open the door on things that require briefing and maybe even a hearing like attorney fees, it might get us in trouble with that 30-day deadline for the arbitrator to get an award out.
And yet, if that is the rule, then the arbitrators are sent a message that they have to provide a complete resolution of the case, including fees, in a single decision.
I think that certainly is an argument that can be made. I mean, I think in this case, I think if we look at the way the statute is written, the LIDLs, the moving party at the complaint for trial de novo stage, had everything that they needed at the time and as of the May 4th service of the award to make a complaint for trial de novo. I can't dispute and stand here in front of you and say the attorney fee issue, the amount was awarded, but the liability was awarded. They had sought in their claim, they were entitled to fees. They didn't say it's possible one of the parties is going to get fees here. That's not the way the issue was presented. And so as of the May 4th date, I believe their entire position had been determined for them and they could move on to district court. Our position, obviously, is that they didn't timely do that and that we think Judge Leavitt was correct in dismissing the complaint and confirming the award and entering judgment.
Thank you, Mr. Smith.
Thank you.
Mr. Sterling.
Thank you, Your Honor. 38.330 sub 4 doesn't talk about requiring a decision within 30 days of the hearing. It says that you have to have a decision within 30 days of the completion of arbitration. I mean, it's really the same issue. When is the arbitration complete? It's complete when the arbitrator has made a decision on all the issues based on what's been submitted to the arbitrator. So I would say that the arbitration in this particular case wasn't concluded until after the judge had or the arbitrator had received the motion in opposition and any reply within the deadline set on that final issue, the attorney's fees. I noted one thing during the last discussion is that everybody kept referring to appeal, which is natural, and I do it too. We're not talking about an appeal to the district court in this case. We're talking about the filing of a complaint. We're talking about starting a civil action. And, one of the main purposes of arbitration and one of the reasons why arbitration is favored by Nevada and by this court is it's supposed to be a streamlined, easy to understand, cheaper method of resolving disputes. And if we're going to require a complaint to be filed before the arbitration proceedings are even completed, we're really undermining one of the most important goals of the arbitration process in general. And that gets back to the broader issue when we're trying to understand what the legislature intended here when they used this term. We need to look at this whole picture and think about what is reasonable. We have to understand that this is an NRED proceeding, so oftentimes we're dealing with parties that don't have attorneys. We're certainly dealing with a consumer protection kind of a statute, dealing with these homeowners associations. They're very prevalent in Nevada. And it's just not reasonable to think that the legislature intended this complicated process with duplicative steps, overlapping, and pitfalls for the unwary. The most reasonable, simply the cleanest, and the most fair and efficient is simply to say that the arbitrator has to decide all of the issues in the claim. This arbitration of NRED matters requires that a written claim be submitted so we know what all the issues are. They're in that document, and we have that written document in this case. What we also have, the decision of the arbitrator, first May 4th decision, and the arbitrator specifically says there are 11 issues that have been submitted to me as part of this claim. I'm looking at page 53. It actually starts on page 49 of the appendix. But the arbitrator says there are 11 issues. He goes through each one of them. He gets to number 10, prevailing party. For purposes of attorney's fees and costs, the prevailing party in this arbitration is clearly the respondent. And then he says, as the prevailing party, they're entitled to attorney's fees and costs under the CC&Rs. And the claimant might file its application for the same, and he gives a deadline, and also provides for an opposition on the amount of costs only. So it's not like it was unclear in this case whether or not the what the claim was and whether or not it was incomplete. It was clearly incomplete based on the documents in the case filed by the parties and also, most importantly, by the arbitrator himself. I've got a couple minutes left. Unless the court has any other specific questions right now, I want to address one just point. It's a small point, but it's an important one that's brought up by the association, and this is the notion of exhaustion of administrative remedies. There is a number 11 in the arbitrator's first decision that finds that the Lytles have exhausted their administrative remedies. But what the arbitrator is talking about here is not whether or not the arbitration process is final, but whether the parties have met the requirement of the statute that any claim, before filing any claim, that you first exhaust any remedies that are required by the CC&Rs, that you have to go through the association to resolve. It's an entirely different issue. That's what it means when they're talking about administrative remedies on page 54. It's the requirement in 38.310(1) little b that requires all administrative procedures required by the covenants to have been fulfilled before you can file your complaint. And that's what's being resolved here. It has nothing to do with whether or not the arbitration proceeding itself was complete, because we know it wasn't. We still have the attorney's fees amount, the reasonableness of the fees to be decided. Indulgence. Let's just see if there was anything else that I needed. I think that's all I had. So unless the court has any questions, I'll leave it at that.
Thank you, Mr. Sterling. Thank you to both parties. This case will stand submitted. The court will be in recess until tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock. Thank you.